Let me just say a few things. I know some other people who are coming, so I'm not going to really start. But I have a few things, and I wanted to hear from you also. This is a sign-up sheet. I'll pass it around. If you want, I have a bibliography I can send you that has books and internet sources. I'll send you my home phone. If you have any questions, please call me. I'm always available for questions.
The description is a little mysterious. I'm like,
money should not be mysterious.
That's what the problem. Talk about. There's a lot of aspects about money.
That's the problem. I just like to hear first from people in the room if you want to talk and just why you came to this particular panel.
Because money is the root of all evil.
Who said that?
I don't know.
I heard that. I've also heard, which is more apropos this conference, this panel, follow the money.
Yeah.
Follow the money. Anybody else?
We were talking earlier, and the monetary system is something that people do not understand, and there are some basic assumptions in it that are complete disaster that make it completely absurd and non-functional, and it has to blow up someday, as far as I can tell. It's just ridiculous. The exponential growth thing is absurd.
Okay. I've heard that. A lot of people are talking about that. Anybody else want to just talk a little about why you're interested in this particular topic?
I'm currently managing a farm, but also study the economics of cooperatives, including some of the history of it, although there's a lot that I don't know. And I'm really interested in building alternative economies that are based on a type of community that I would rather be engaging in. And I think that there's a huge amount to learn from organizing attempts that have been made in the past, and I'd like to learn particularly about this instance.
Absolutely. And we will learn a lot from the Farmers Alliance. I learned a lot. The reason I got interested in this specific piece of history was my friend of mine suggested to read a book called The Populist Moment. And I said, what's that about? And he said, no, it's about these farmers who built this national movement. And I said, what? I said, I never heard about that. I went to high school and college, and I took history in college. They didn't teach me that. And when I come across information that I've never heard about, but is part of the history of my country, my ears go up right away. What's going on here? And this piece of history, you know, that in the schools, the history is pretty controlled. Education has been not only controlled in this country for many years, but it started in England. The English aristocracy were very clear they had to control what was taught in their universities. So there's a lot that we should have access to that we don't, unfortunately. And that's one of the reasons I go around and talk to people, because I love books, and I get into these old books that have such truth in them that I never got in my university, that and is so relevant to our lives today. Just like, well, what did this movement do that made them so successful? And then why didn't they get the goal that they wanted? And so we can study this. There's a lot of resources. These farmers wrote newspapers, books, everything. So there's a lot of resources about what worked and didn't work in a mass movement, which we could use today, you know, learn from them. So I'm going to start.
Can I just ask you, the populist moment, do you have the author?
Lawrence Goodwin, G-O-O-D-W-Y-N.
Thank you.
Yeah. So my name is Sue Peters. I've come to know for
This is my fourth year. It's the first year I've done a panel. But my fourth year coming here because I studied permaculture, and some of my permaculture friends were coming to NOFR. So they said, oh, come, and so I came, and I really liked it. I really like, you know, I'm a city girl. I grew up in New York. I'm still living there. I lived there most of my life. And I knew nothing about farming, you know. But I would love to go to these panels and hear about, you know, the crops and the machines and the trees. And then along the way, what happened to me was I fell into this passionate desire to understand this history of money, because its control on us is immense. It's the one item in our life that controls life and death, if you think about it. If you don't have money, you're homeless. You can't buy food. No other item in our lives has that power. I can't think of any. The other thing to remember about money is it's unique because of this power. All the rulers from the beginning of civilization have known this. Rulers have always been aware of the power of money. Of course, they don't encourage the people to understand it, because then they can't manipulate us. Today we're very manipulated, right? Okay, so let me see how this is here. Okay, so we're going to first, it's going to be two parts. What is money? Where does our money come from? And what are the effects of the current monetary system? So just the current. Because if the most important thing with money is, if you don't understand what it is, and most people don't. If you walk up to an ordinary person and you say, where does money come from? They look at you and they go, no, I never thought about that. And they haven't thought about it because it's not taught. And it's not taught because then we don't have control of our lives and the ability to change the current monetary system. That's why it's not taught. So I'm going to focus on that to make sure. And let me just say, you probably won't get it in the first time. It's tricky because we're all living in this fishbowl of money, right? You know, you're a fish and you're in water. You never think about the water. You just know it's there. So to get out of that fishbowl and see what the water is can be very tricky. I'm going to try to keep the language very simple for that reason. Okay, and maybe do, if some of you would be willing to come up and do a few skits with me, it might help. Okay? But that's probably the most critical thing, is to get your hands around what is money, because you will be told many things in the media about money. And you need to know what the core personality of it is. What is it? Then we'll have a little question and answer. And then we're going to go into the Alliance Movement. What was the monetary system when the Farmers Alliance organized? This is 1880s. Then what was the Farmers Alliance itself? Right? A little bit of the history, which is fascinating. And then at the end, this is actually, say to people, when you learn about this, at least when I first learned about this, because I was as ignorant of it as any American, I felt so self-empowered because I could understand the way the world was today. That's the self-empowerment of educating yourself. So I would like to leave people with that, with what needs to be done today for a more just monetary system. Okay? So let's see. What is money? Okay, so I started to talk about money is unique, the power of life and death. Nothing else has that power, right? It's essential for society. That's the other thing. If you go and you study ancient histories or, you know, the Middle Ages, if the historian doesn't describe the monetary system and who controls it, then you don't understand how that society works. Because no society can exist without money. The Babylonians, the Tigris and Euphrates, those, they were the first real civilizations. They had money. But if you read the historians, no one mentions it. Well, who controls the money controls the society. It's just the way it works. Money is necessary to have a society. So if you study any history, ask yourself the first question, what is the money in that country and who controls it? Okay? It's indispensable for society to function. It's like your blood in your body. It creates commerce. It creates interchange between people. And it creates the ability of every one of us to get our needs met. Food, shelter, education, health care, whatever it is. The basic needs, you need money. Okay? So it's indispensable. And it's a human invention. It came along with civilization. You know, and it's something that the society determined, usually in law or custom. Okay? Today it exists in law, has for many centuries. So the law determines what the money is for that society. So it's a social contract. Okay? It's not the gold and silver dug up from the ground that might be used as money and function as money, but the actual use of whatever we're using to the exchange and get our needs met, that is the money. Okay? So it's taken many forms. We have paper money, right? Today we have Federal Reserve notes. We used to have national bank notes back at the time of the Farmers Alliance. We had gold and silver coins in Sparta. Back in the ancient Greek times, they used iron discs as money. They didn't want gold or silver. They wanted iron discs. So keep in mind that money is defined in the law as that medium of exchange, okay? So, and it's a human invention, right? It's the humans who write the law. Okay, and this is typical, but important to think about. What's the uses of money that make it so powerful in our lives? So we always hear a means of exchange, a ticket, right? So I can, you know, work, earn some money, and go and buy that apple, so I can eat and live. Okay? So the money is used to get what I need as a ticket, as a means of exchange. Okay? It's not wealth. Wealth would be this building, that land, things like that. So money would be a ticket to exchange to get wealth. Now this is the next one is very important. It'll have a lot to do with what we talk about with the Farmers Alliance and today. Money is a store of stable value. So if I earn $100 today and I put it in my checking account, right? In 10 years, I would hope, I would want, it's not true, but I would want to take that $100 out of my checking account and be able to buy the same amount of food as 10 years ago when I labored for that money. I want a stable store of value. Of course, that's not true today. I would be able to buy less, right? Because you're an unstable price in our society. This is very important. The quantity of money in any society must be controlled. So you have the King of England, and the money in the medieval England was gold and silver coins. And the king issued them. The public authority, the king, he issued them. And you have to be sure, they will tell you this, but those kings, and there's sources you can go to, knew exactly how much money they had. And they were very concerned to keep the price stable, right? So literally for hundreds of years, they kept that price stable because they knew all of the peasants and the artisans and all the people that they lorded over. If that price got too high and those people were starving, he wasn't going to be king for very long. So he knew very clearly that he had to control the quantity of that gold and silver that circulated around his kingdom, or else the price would not stay stable and he wouldn't be king very long. So it was something they just knew. Queen Elizabeth knew it. She was very clear. The first thing she did when she took over the crown was she got her privy council together and she said, okay, tell me about my money. What's the state of the realm with the money? She's a very smart woman, you know? So the quantity of the circulating currency, of the circulating money in any society has to be controlled if you want stable prices. And I think all of us, if you think about it, would want stable prices. You'd want to know if I'm planning my farm and in 10 years I know I'm going to have so much produce to sell, well, what is the cost of it today? I would want to know. Am I going to get the same in 10? You would want the same, so you can plan. Businesses do it all the time. They have to plan. So if the price of commodities is not stable, the society is very much at a disadvantage. The people, the producers in the society, they can't plan ahead. So this is the bottom line in terms of a money system, okay? And I have to say, today our money system is the privately owned Federal Reserve System, and you have to know that those banks know exactly how much money is in circulation every single day. And I'll say that because my career before this was I was in computers. I was a systems designer. And since I lived in New York, I worked for large corporations. I would go into the large corporation and I would live with their data, and then I would design a new system for them based on the relationships of the data. And I used to do brokerage houses. And I also, the other quality of me that got me to this point is when I would go in and have a job, I always want to know, wait a minute, okay, I understand the data files, I understand this, but I want to know, what's this business really about? I mean, why are they doing this? And I remember in the 1990s, I was working for this medium-sized brokerage house, and I was managing the system that had mortgage-backed securities, right? Has everybody heard about them in terms of the credit crisis, right? And I processing them was not a big deal, but I would say, I remember I'd say, well, what's this all about? I mean, I never saw them before, and I saw stocks and bonds, and I went out actually into the literature, finance literature, and I couldn't, even reading that, I couldn't figure out why these things were being produced. And then, of course, the credit crisis came, and we all found out why they were being produced, you know, to create havoc for us. Not for the bankers, but for us.
How much money is in circulation?
Well, the money supply of the United States.
The money supply in 1980 was $1 trillion. In 1995, it was $4 trillion. In the year 2000, it was $7 trillion. In 2010, it was $10 trillion. And today, 2013, it's $12 trillion.
Came about because of the 90s and, you know, then the credit crisis, you know, the bubble of the mortgage backs, the mortgages. We'll go into that a little later.
So can I just ask you, how did you answer that question? Why, you know, mortgage-backed securities, I never could back then.
I couldn't find it in the finance literature. They weren't, because they weren't going to walk up to you and say, well, we're doing this because, you know, we're going to offload these to the investors and make a lot of money creating these, you know.
I mean, it was a product to sell. They created a product to sell.
Yeah. But it is a major, major product, major effect on all of our lives. You know. Okay. It's a measure of value, meaning it's denominated. So I have a dollar bill, it has one on it, and I have a $10 bill, it has $10 on it. Right? By law, right? So created by man in law. And a means of payment, right? If I have a debt, I owe my taxes, I need to be able to pay with money, right? If you owe the insurance company money, they have to take your money, your U.S. money, right? It's a means of payment. Okay. So this is how we use this unique item called money. It's not a commodity, it's not gold and silver, something you hold in your hand. It's in the law, decided what it is, okay? And it's not debt. It's not debt. If you pay a debt, right, the debt disappears, right? So I owe the bank some money. Well, let's hold that. Money doesn't disappear. Money circulates. Okay. If I have a quarter and I use it to pay for something, that person in the store gets it, and it doesn't disappear. He gives it to the next customer who needs cash. Right? Money doesn't disappear. It circulates.
What about when it disappears in bad investments?
Well, a bad investment is something different. An investment is not money. You buy money, you use money to buy an investment, okay? Okay, yeah, that's why the nature of money is very important to get clear on. Okay, so it's not that, it's money that circulates. If you could hold your questions a little bit, we'll have an opportunity for them. Okay, I love this man, Edward Kellogg. 1861, he wrote a book, A New Monetary System. He was down on Pearl Street in New York, actually. He was a merchandiser. He grew up on a farm, and then he learned how to merchandise, and he started his own business, and there was a panic and depression in 1837, and he was wiped out. But he was a very moral man, he was very religious, and I love these guys, these women and men, who have calamities in their life, and then they get up and he writes, well, you know, when that happened to me, he said, I walked around and I looked around and I said, why? He wanted to know why. And he got back on his feet and wrote this book and had another business, actually. I love this, the most important fundamental law in any nation is that which institutes money. Right? I've been saying it's in the law. For money governs the distribution of property. Well, we talk about concentration of wealth today. The law is unjust, and that's why we have concentration of wealth. So he knew this, you know, he self-educated man, this man. For money governs the distribution of property, and thus affects in a thousand ways the relations of man to man. Okay, hold your question. you know what, if you have questions, write them down, because I don't want you to lose them, okay? It's just that it'd be better if I went through. Okay. So where does money come from? Okay. Can I have a volunteer? Someone who would like to come up in the front? Yes, thank you. Just, right. You're walking into a bank and you have $100 to put in your checking account. Okay. And I'm the banker. Okay. So, okay, so you want to deposit it? Thank you. And how much money do you have in our bank?
$3,000?
Very good, thank you. Okay, we'll take good care of it.
Okay.
Right now, by law, in any commercial bank in the United States, in our monetary system, when a depositor comes in and puts their money in their checking account, they have loaned me their money. They no longer own it. So if I go out of business for whatever reason, you must line up with the other creditors that I owe.
Americans. That little sign that says you're protected up to
FDIC insurance.
What does that mean?
Well, that is good. That's still good. You can still get insured.
I understand that if you have under $250,000, yes. You're okay.
Right. And if you happen to have more than $250,000 and not anything above that, you have to get in line with the creditors, and I might have enough assets, you know, to pay you. Probably 30 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar. It's in the law. This is the legal system. This is legal system. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Most people get very shocked by that. I got shocked by it because I put my money in, I mean, I have my money in my checking account, you know? Okay.
Is it different than a savings account or no? It's the same thing.
Savings account, let's stick with checking accounts, because then it's not that much money in savings accounts in relation to checking accounts. Okay. Okay. Can I have one more volunteer? Okay. Now, you're a farmer and you come to the bank to borrow money. Okay? And you want to buy some land. You need a $100,000 mortgage. Okay. Stay right there. I'm the banker, right? Okay. Our money in this country today, the bulk of it, 97%, is privately issued money. Wait a minute. I thought we lived in a democracy. The most important item in our life, money, is under the control of private parties. Nobody told me about this when I went to college. Okay.
And it's not just
private commercial banks, which are the ones we love, all the too big to fail banks. And all the banks, you know, in our towns, the commercial banks, anything with a checking account is pretty much a commercial bank. They're the ones that make loans. They help have your money in the checking accounts so that you can pay your bills as a means of payment, right? You write checks as a means of payment. That's one of the functions.
It jumped a slide.
Oh.
Keeps jumping.
Oh, no, really? It's not my computer. Okay. Well, these private banks, this is what happens. Okay, so you come in, and I'm the banker, and I have the mortgage document. It's all legal, right? It's all in the print. I'm going to give you $100,000 mortgage, okay. But you need to sign this. Okay, so sign it.
What's all that fine print?
You can show it to your lawyer, but you know, we do this all the time, I'm sure. You know, we've done it for
years.
Okay,
that's fine.
Yeah. So in your account at the bank, at this checking account, I am going to type in $100,000. Now look in your account. Is it there? Do you see it in your account?
I think I do.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
What, is this a trick question?
No.
Yeah.
Just say, okay. But where did I get it from? Where
deposits.
Did I get it from?
Deposits. Like
deposits.
The money that she put in the bank.
No.
No.
No, you take
it's
it.
Negative.
No.
You know you'll get it back
it's
from
a debt.
Him plus
yeah.
some after.
Yeah, but where did I get the $100,000 to give him, to put in his checking account?
Presumably from all the other borrowers.
You typed it in.
I just typed it in. I made it up. So now, just from him signing that, my typing into his checking account, $100,000, I have expanded the money supply by $100,000. This happens every time someone borrows from a private commercial bank, every time. This happens for 97% of all the money our country, all of us citizens, use to get our food, a roof over our house, send our kids to school, whatever. No one ever told you about this in school, and even if you went to economics, they're not going to tell you about this, because economists defend the current system and they really don't want this changed, right? Unfortunately. There's a few economists that will talk about this, right? But very few of them would keep their jobs if they did, okay? This form of what I'm telling you, this 97% of all our money, all these checking accounts, thank you very much. You're
going to
pay me back, right?
No, I'll think about it. I'm a bad debt.
This money, and I'll put it in quotes, because it's not really money, it's called bank credit. So our money system, based in the 1913 Federal Reserve Law, made it legal to use bank credit as our money. Okay, and remember what I said, money really, it shouldn't appear and then disappear. And I'll tell you how it disappears, okay? Bank credit is used as money. It's not money, but it's used as money legally, according to the Federal Reserve Law. Okay, but it's really debt. This is really hard to keep your mind straight, right? I, the banker, just gave him $100,000, but it's $100,000 of debt. So it's being used as money, but it's debt. And what do the banks want when they give you a loan?
Interest.
97% of our money is making interest to the banks. Think of that. You know, Ford, what is the name? Henry Ford, right? The car manufacturer. He knew this. He knew about the system. And he once said, you know, if the American people ever knew how the banks work, there would be a revolution by morning. Because think of it. They have us in this fishbowl using bank credit for our money. And we're all working to pay them back with interest on what we need as decent human beings to have a life, what our society needs to have a decent society without all this concentration of wealth. And this is the core. The bank credit used as money is the core of their power. Okay? This is what's causing the problems today. Okay. So, no, the bank does not take deposits, no, and make loans. That's what we think, that's what they want us to think. Absolutely, by law, I can give you sources. The Federal Reserve itself has a book called Modern Money Mechanics, and it says it right in there. When a bank creates a deposit, it's creating new,
it's
creating new money. It's the exact opposite. Loans create deposits. new bank credit used as money. This is the core of our money system, our private banking system. And it's why the banks had to be bailed out in 2008, okay? Okay, so here's our money supply. 3% is coins minted by the U.S. Mint, our public mint, and our U.S. Treasury spends them into the economy for us, right? Government expense. 3% also are the bills, the dollar bills and $10 and $20 bills, cash, okay? And we think that that's government money. The government prints it. U.S. Printing Office, which is owned by the government, prints it. But, well, the bankers are so greedy. But by law, they changed the law. So now the government office might print them, but the government sells them to the private Federal Reserve banks at cost. At cost. So it maybe costs 3 cents to make a dollar bill or a $10 bill. And the private Federal Reserve Bank, they're the ones that get to spend it, not us. Even that, they're so greedy, they couldn't even leave this to us, right? And then, of course, here's the checking accounts, which are the 97% of all the other money all of us use, right? The bank credit, the ones the banks create and get back the loan with interest. Okay. And Edward Kellogg, the man from the 1840s, he knew. That whole book that he wrote was about interest and how interest, except he did make one exception. He said possibly 1% interest might not concentrate wealth in the life of one person. Maybe. Anything above 1% is concentrating the wealth of the society into the hands of who controls the money. Is the interest. And the Catholic Church knew that for generations. Before the Catholic Church, the rulers knew that. In Babylonia, they would have silver coins. Some of their money, what they used for money, part of it, those silver coins, and the temples would loan it out at interest, and it caused debt slavery to the extent that what the ruler, the king, would do is every 50 years, because so many people were getting into debt, because the concentration of wealth through the interest, he would have debt jubilees, and he'd say, okay, all the debts are gone, we're starting afresh. So they knew from the dawn of history that interest concentrates wealth. Of course, the bankers won't tell you that, right? Because they're getting interest on all of our money, right?
Can I ask a really quick clarification on that last point?
Yeah.
You said it's sold at cost to the Federal Reserve. Do you mean...
It's what?
You said, it says it's printed by the U.S. Treasury and sold at cost to the private Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Is it sold for the cost of printing?
Yeah, it's like 3 cents or something to
print. The Federal Reserve pays 3 cents and gets a $5 bill?
Yes.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And that was a recent change within the last, 10 years. But it's like they couldn't even allow us that, you know, that for our public treasury. They had to take that, you know. Okay, so, and so the Fed came into existence in 1913, secretly written by a European banker and several American bankers in 1910. Okay, there's many books written about that. Of course, nobody knew about that till the 1930s, when the bankers who were secretly writing this, They got older and older, and then they wrote their memoirs, and then they couldn't die without saying something about what they did. So we know about it, you know. And the worst banker, the one who really knew this system of bank credit, was Paul Warburg, who was from the Warburg Bank a whole family bank. There's a long history in Germany. And he came over, this is fascinating. He came over in 1902, he's a German citizen. He had studied banking. His family was very, at a prestigious bank in Europe, wealthy. And he came over, prior to 1902, he came over and he married the daughter of a man called Schiff, who was a partner in the most important investment banking firm in New York, Kuhnloh. But he didn't relocate here till 1902. 1902, he comes back, and he becomes a partner in his father-in-law's firm, a partner. Now, think of this. It's very unusual. This is 1902. As a partner, they give him a salary of, in 1902, $500,000. I mean, unbelievable. I said, what did he do for this? Well, this is what he did for it. He didn't do any work that their partner does. He just went around the country talking to different banking groups, explaining how we needed reform in this country and we needed a central bank because he knew central banking. The bankers in this country really didn't know central banking. This, what I've described, the bank credit, the creation of money out of debt, is a central banking. This is the way it works, right? And he knew that. And he was instrumental in actually writing the law itself. And he actually became on the first board of governors of the new Federal Reserve System. So he had the Federal Reserve, the 12 Federal Reserve banks. The most important one is the New York Federal Reserve. If you look at the balance sheets of these Federal Reserve banks, you'll see most of the assets of the Federal Reserve System are in New York. Most of all the big banks are the ones that are domiciled in New York. Okay, so you have Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, UBS, HSBC, Deutsche Bank. A lot of foreign banks have come over and domiciled in New York in order to become part of the key control mechanism of the monetary system, the New York Fed. And it's just very interesting. I mean, these are all the too big to fail banks, Oh, and all of these commercial banks that are members of the New York Fed, only they can own the shares of the New York Fed. New York Fed is a corporation. It's, all the shares are owned by its member banks, okay? Has a lot of power. Okay. What are the effects of this monetary system? We could look around today in our lives of what's happened to our relatives. I have friends who are deeply in debt. You hear about the college debt, right? Our government's in debt. We're in debt, like $16 trillion of debt for government, right? Credit card debt, what other debt? We'll see. Okay, so let's think about this. The bank creates a deposit in the borrower's account for the principal of the loan. Okay, the loan, that $100,000 to buy that land, that's the principal of the loan. And he'll give it to buy the land, and it'll circulate in our money supply. Okay, so the deposits will circulate. And, a lot of times it's by check. Sometimes we use debit cards, right, and moving money around. But it's all the same. It's accounting money. It's in our checking accounts. Okay? When the borrower repays the loan, the principal is erased. Oh, well, let's see the other thing. Because when he pays off the $100,000, I erase that from my accounting book. I don't put it in my vault, right? It disappears. It's an accounting money. So I created it out of debt, me the banker, It now is existing in his checking account. The borrower pays it off back to the bank. I erase it. What's happened to the money supply? Smaller. So I, the private bank, have the power to expand the money supply. Think of the housing bubble, giving loans to everybody. I am expanding the money supply. As those loans are either paid off or default, the money supply is smaller. So what I do, what my industry does, what this system does, is you have private parties controlling the quantity of the money that we all need. Right? I make loans, the loans are paid off. I make more loans, those loans default, whichever way they're paid off or default. I am determining with my policies how much money we have. And remember what I said, if you want a stable price, you have to control the quantity of this unique, indispensable thing we call money. And it's not under the control of our public authorities. Okay? It's under the control of this private banking system. Okay, so when the money supply is increased, you get a bubble, and commodity prices rise, right? That's called inflation, right? The housing prices rise. They also call it asset price inflation, right? When the housing prices rise. Okay, but when the money supply is decreased, think of the Great Depression of the 30s. The 20s was a bubble, the 1920s. You had a bubble in the stock market, we all heard of, but there was also a bubble in the mortgage market, right? A lot of mortgage loans were given, a lot of stock loans, they called them margin loans. Well, all of those loans were pulled back, and I have some sources, though I don't like to go in that area, but even reputable economists who have studied the Great Depression will say that the Federal Reserve caused the Great Depression, Federal Reserve banking system, because they withdrew money from the system. So you call in margin loans, people have to sell their stock, and you have stock market crash. And this bust we call deflation. Economists will say the money supply decreased or deflated, prices went down, there's very little money in circulation. And what do you have? You have unemployment, homelessness, which we have today, right? This depression that we all hear about, the Farmer Alliance was in the midst of something called the Long Depression. We call this the Great Depression. Back then, historians, when they look back, they look at the financial system, they're talking, and they call it the Long Depression, which lasted from after the Civil War up through around 1900. And in that period, the supply of what was used as money was slowly being down more and more. The prices of farm commodities, of everything, but this is the Farmers Alliance, and most people at that time were farmers. After the Civil War, we were a country of farmers. The prices of those commodities were down and down. Okay? That's how the money system works. You have to control the quantity. Whoever controls the money system controls the society. Just for this reason, you can create a bubble or you can create a bust. Bubbles aren't as bad as busts.
You said the commodity prices went down, they went up.
Don't they go down in a deflation? When the circulating currency is less, there's less money going for the goods and services, so the price is smaller. When you increase the amount of money, then there's more money going after those goods and services, and the price goes up. So during a bubble, like the housing bubble, the price of houses went up, right? Because there was much more money out there running after those houses. But the bust is the worst, because in a bust, when you have less money for everybody to get their needs met, the producers, manufacturers, small businessmen, they can't make profit. Right? The prices have gone so low, they can't make a profit. So what do? They lay people off. They're affected as much as workers are. But producers are usually in a little better shape because they're not totally dependent on a salary. So then you get, this is when you get the unemployment, and then once you have unemployment, you have starvation and homelessness. There is no stability in our economy. It causes grief, fear, poverty, and it causes death, early death. You don't have money, you can't go to the doctor. You can't get those pills that you need, whatever. Interest concentrates wealth, we talked about this, has done so since the first civilization, and it creates debt slaves. The worst thing we've done is to our college students, we've allowed the law to be changed so that college debt cannot be gotten rid of through bankruptcy. So you have college students who have debt and can't get rid of it and can't get a job to pay it off. So what is that? That's a debt slave. You're working for these private banks. Okay, so this is some of the effects. So one of the first things that this system wants and always wanted, and this our system comes from the Bank of England, which was created in 1694 and was a private bank. Doesn't sound like a private bank, but back then it was a private bank. The first thing they did was they got the government of England into debt. Okay? There is no reason why a government has to borrow money from a private bank in order to have money. In our Constitution.
Your slideshows are on the right.
What?
Your slideshows are on the right.
Oh. Not my computer. Okay. In our Constitution, we have the Constitution. It's right in the Constitution. We, our government, can create our own money. And historically, we did in this country. The colonies issued their own money. They don't talk about that, right? They only talk about austerity, the government is too much in debt. No government needs to be in debt. Okay.
So letting the banks do this was like a constitutional amendment, in effect.
No, it's part of the original Constitution.
No, letting originally the government would issue money. But letting the banks have control is essentially a constitutional amendment.
You could make it a constitutional issue. You could take it to court and say the Federal Reserve Law of 1913 is unconstitutional. You could do that. And there have been senators who knew the immorality of this system and did try to do that in our history. Not all of them are sold out. And here's the interest. Just the interest on our government debt. Almost half of our income tax every year. All the income tax you pay to the federal government, almost half of it, 40-some-odd%, goes to pay the interest on our debt. And of course, a good part of that interest is going to those banks that we bailed out. Okay. So here you have the boom and bust cycle. This is the gains of the bankers. They know how to control the amount of currency, the amount of money, right? Because they make the loans, so they know how to control it, right? And so they know how to create a bubble, and they know how to create a bust. And when they love those busts, because remember, they don't usually make a loan unless they have collateral. You know, your farmland, your foreign house. And then when the bus comes, you might have to foreclose, right? Because you can't pay your debts. And then they get wealthier. Again, this cycle of boom and bust is the concentration of the wealth, right? Where am I?
You've run ahead again.
It's like got its own mind here. Okay.
Okay. Press play.
Okay. So here's the interest, right? Concentrating the wealth. The interest on all of our money that's being created by private bank credit. And they decide who gets the money. So look at this. Who's getting the money? The stock and bond markets, the derivatives, right? All of the non-productive aspects of our society. We all wonder, like, why is this all this, these bets being, you know, created and these huge markets that don't, that are not part of the real economy, like farming, right? Or manufacturing. Well, they're getting the loans. So that's why who controls the money system controls what that society is going to be, right? They're going to give the loans to the currency trader. They're not going to give them to the small businessman. You know. And that leads to concentration of power. So they write the laws. They have the money to fund the lobbyists, right? They have the money to have wars. You can't have a war unless you have money. And these banks make a lot of money with loans to the arms dealers and everything, right? They're deciding, remember, that they're private corporations. They're deciding who they're giving their loans to, okay? They're, and you can't go to their board of directors and sit in and give, you know, and say...
Sorry.
That's okay, okay? Media concentration. You're not going to hear this in the media because they own the media, right? And here's all of us in debt. Student debt, $1 trillion. Credit card debt, $0.8 trillion. Mortgage debt, $13 trillion. Corporate debt, $8.7 trillion. State and local government, $3 trillion. Federal government, $16.4 trillion. Total private corporate government debt, $42.9 trillion. This is right from the Federal Reserve. They have all these statistics online. You just go online and you can see very nice, you know, statistics. But they don't tell you about the system. Okay. So I'm going to stop here and just ask questions before we go on to the Farmers Alliance. If there's, and I know that it's just difficult. This, it's like coming out of the fish tank and having to see the world differently.
So if the Constitution says that the government can create money and we're allowing the private banks to create the money, is that unconstitutional?
No. I can safely say no. If the Constitution says the government can create money, that's a positive thing that the government can do. It doesn't say private banks can't. You know what I mean?
It's not exclusive.
Right.
It's not exclusive, right.
Are you a lawyer?
Yes, or soon to be.
That's, well, it's this is a legal, it will be fought out in the courts. I wish it was fought out in the courts. It doesn't even get to the courts.
If it said only the government should create it, that'd be different.
Right.
Yeah. And what about credit unions? This does not apply to credit unions?
No, they don't issue bank credit like private commercial banks.
It only applies to the Federal Reserve.
In our country today, only commercial banks create bank credit, which we use as money, makes up our money supply. Commercial banks can either be chartered by the national government or by the state government. If it's a nationally chartered bank, it is mandatory to be a member of the Federal Reserve System. State banks have a choice. They can apply or not. Only 15% of state banks are members of the Federal Reserve System. However, in the Federal Reserve System, in the national banks and those state member banks, 3/4 of our nation deposits reside. In other words, 3/4 of our money supply are in banks that are members of the Federal Reserve System.
In New York, there's over 130 member banks in the New York Fed. But the big banks are the ones that own most of the shares. You get your, if you join the New York Fed as a private commercial bank, you get a certain portion of the shares of that New York Fed bank, but only in proportion to your size, like the amount of deposit. So the big banks, the Goldman Sachs and the Citigroup and everything, they have more clout than the other banks.
So is this a reason why Bitcoins, that's it. There's a resistance from the Feds to make it more widely used?
I don't know. I haven't studied Bitcoin. I know they don't like any example.
No, right.
Alternative to this system. That's why the Farmers Alliance, in the Civil War, Lincoln issued the greenback. Now you're talking. The greenback was issued by the U.S. Treasury debt-free. It was just a paper money that was spent to keep the Union together. That's why he issued it. He first went to take loans, and the bankers were saying, oh, you have to pay me 36%. And he got really mad. He came back. He was in New York talking to the New York banks because they've always been the big powerhouses in New York. They've always had the largest loans to give, the most bank credit. He came back and one of his friends actually, had the name of the man. He's talking to him and he said, well, Abe, he said, in the Constitution, you can issue the money. Mm-hmm. And that's why he did. And he issued greenbacks, and they circulated 450 million dollars of greenbacks at the time. And the bankers went crazy, because here was an example of something that wasn't, under their control. And they went, and there's a whole history to how they went and the laws that they got passed in Congress to try to snuff that currency out. They were successful up to a point, but the Treasury issued greenbacks up to 1931. I'm not mistaken. It's in here. They couldn't get rid of it, and that's the farmers knew about the money system back then, and they supported the greenback. They knew about the manipulation of the quantity of money because they saw their prices going down and down, and they couldn't get out of debt. So they were totally supportive of the greenback. Right?
And it's also still, it's illegal to create your own currency now, because I know we were looking into farmers' money to be used at the farmer's market, and it's like, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this, and they'll come after you. And
you can create your own currency, but you can't back it in precious metals.
Well, I didn't even think it was that much.
There's Berkshires out here. It's backed by the Federal Reserve, so it's sort of it's a local currency. And there's 120 local currencies around the country, something like that.
And more around the world, yeah.
But you have to be careful. I mean, I was reading about one, one of the members of the local currency was talking, and he said, wow, he said, this local currency has been really good for me. He said, I'm able to do this job, and I can support myself. And I thought, if that gets too successful, the IRS is going to come right in and say, okay, well, you're not paying tax on that. You see how they can go in and destroy a local currency,
Because, but you might be paying taxes on it if you're keeping track of the exchange.
But who are you giving the tax to? Anyway, that's a whole other discussion, local currency, which I support.
Yeah.
But I don't see them as a real solution. Okay. They definitely do good. Okay, so what was the monetary system when the Farmers Alliance organized? Okay. First, if this thing will stop,
Okay, well, let's go by this. Okay. You know, the people of the United States in the 17th and 18th century knew so much more about money than we did because they had examples of real money in their life, like the greenback, right? And they knew that the banker's money wasn't for their benefit, right? So there was always a struggle in our American history, always a struggle between the public control of money and the private control of money. And it's a fascinating history. It's fascinating. At the time of the Farmers Alliance, the American people were aware of the power given to the issue of money. Right? Whoever issues the money controls that society. Can you hold your question? Just write it down. Women's struggles were part of the public, money struggles, women too, money struggles were part of the public discourse throughout the 18th and 19th century. It was an issue, right? Why are those private banks, you know, what are they doing with our money? Okay. And it is because we're actually lucky in our country because we have a history of publicly issued money that circulates for the benefit of the people. It's not true of European history. They don't have that history to fall back on. We do. We're just not given it in our schools, okay? So you have the colonial governments, okay? What happened in the colonies, okay? You had gold and silver coin. That's where English colonies, they had gold and silver coin. That was the money of England. And it circulated, but there wasn't very much of it. There wasn't very much of it, right? The colonies were supposed to exist for the motherland, for England. The gold and silver would go back to England in payment of taxes, colonial taxes. And there wasn't much money, so there wasn't much commerce in the colonies, to the extent that in around the 1660s, you had colonists who had come over and were going back to Europe because they couldn't survive here without money. Remember, you need money to have a society. There was very little money. So you actually had colonists going back to England. So what happened? Americans, remember, money is a human invention. Americans, Massachusetts, 1690, they created, the colonial legislature issued paper money. They called them bills of credit. Right away, you had money, you had the ability to exchange things, you had the development of some commerce in the colonies. It saved the colonies. Right? People, they became prosperous, and it spread. And one thing to research, Benjamin Franklin, he's an incredible person, everything he did. And he knew about money, what money was, and he was instrumental in taking the idea of his bills of credit from Massachusetts and taking it to Pennsylvania. I mean, it went that way or the other way around. I mean, he just was spreading the word. Hey, you know, we can have a prosperous colony, but you need money. And we have the colonial legislatures issued it, and it circulated, and commerce was prosperous. 1776 to 1781, the Continental Congress, during the Revolutionary War, issued Continentals, paper money issued by the government, the Continental Congress, right? And it circulated, right? And what do we learn in our history books? Continentals were terrible. They printed so many of them. The Continental Congress printed so much of it, it became worthless, right? There was so much inflation. This is what they teach you. What they don't say is that in New York Harbor during the war, Revolutionary War, were two ships from England counterfeiting day and night these Continentals. Economic warfare, Economic warfare. It's more effective than blowing people up. You blow up their money, they can't exchange, they can't get what they need, you destroy the society. So that's what they don't teach in school. You know, the British were counterfeiting this. You can go into history books, the ones, you know, that are in the libraries, but not taught in colleges. And, there would be newspaper, you know, signs in the newspapers. Come to this tavern at such and such an hour, and we'll give you continentals. Right? The British were spreading them out, economic warfare.
To create inflation, so it would fall
apart.
The colonists must have known about this, weren't they? Why didn't they try?
Hold your question.
Okay.
Write it down. Okay. And during the War of 1812, here's the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8, to coin money, regulate the value. Regulate the value. Control the quantity, right? 1812, 1815, President James Madison needed money for the War of 1812. He issued U.S. notes, public money, and President Lincoln, the greenbacks, and you have the Greenback Party wanted, the Greenback defended. This is their party. And you have the Farmers Alliance, okay, who were very clear on the difference between privately issued money and government issued money. Okay. At the time of the Farmers Alliance, the U.S. Mint issued gold and silver coins, right, our money. The U.S. Treasury issued greenbacks, right, our money. The national banking system, which had been passed in the Civil War, because as soon as the greenbacks were issued, the banks got in there and influenced the legislature and passed a National Bank Act so that...
Prior to the Civil War, paper currency that circulated came from privately owned state-chartered banks. But during the Civil War, the National Bank Act was passed. This created national banknotes issued by private banks chartered at the national level. By putting a tax on the private state-chartered banknotes, this removed them from circulation. So you had the national banknotes circulating along with the greenback. Private money versus public money.
Another thing you have back then, which the Farmers Alliance weren't aware of, even people in the administration and Congress weren't aware of, you had private bank credit, what we were talking about, which we have today. You had it back then too. After the Civil War, approximately half of the money supply was private bank credits, accounting money. But because it's accounting money, especially back then, same even today, because it's accounting money, people were not really aware of it, right? Because back then the farmers would have the coins in their pocket and currency, and that was the money, right? But the private banks were issuing bank money, and back then the big banks, the ones with the most deposits, most accounting money, were the New York banks, and that was the bank of J.P. Morgan, the big financier from the 19th century, and Rockefeller, who was Standard Oil. He had his bank in New York. They were the big, big banks, and they would attract all of the deposits from around the country. Okay. The Farmers Alliance weren't really aware of this, but they were very aware of the difference between this public money and that private money. Very aware.
I don't know who the Farmers Alliance is.
Okay, that's definitely right. Okay. Oh, okay, I'll skip this. This we've gone over. This is a run on the bank. Okay, what was the Farmers Alliance? Here we go. It was a national movement, mostly in the Western Plains farmers and the Southern farmers, okay? Which is bulk of the farmers at that time. I mean, most of the population were farmers. They joined together to form an organization called the National Farmers Alliance, an industrial union, okay? What was its purpose? To more speedily educate ourselves. That was the first thing they thought about. So fascinating. It started in Texas in the 1870s because of the condition of crop farming, cotton farming in the South. All these farmers, caravans of them, were going to Texas to try to get something going on. Right? They couldn't do it in the South. We'll talk about that. And there were these farmers that had some self-respect, and they got together, Lampasas County, Texas, and they sat down and they said, we're gonna fight this. They had some real self-respect. And they started it. And the first thing they said was, we have to educate ourselves in preparation for the day. This is what these three or four farmers said. When all the balance of labor's products become concentrated into the hands of a few, they're to constitute a power that would enslave posterity. They saw it. They saw that their problems came from this money system. And remember, the development of monopolies in this country started in the last half of the 19th century, right? You had the railroad monopolies, you had the money trust, you know, financial monopolies, the steel corporation eventually you got, that was the biggest conglomerate of all was U.S. Steel, 1903. This all was being developed and affecting the population, right? So here's what the Dirt Poor Farmers said. The Farmers Alliance denounced credit merchants, they're from the South, I'll talk about them, railroad monopolies, trusts, money power, capitalists, the two-price credit system, which is also from the South, and they educated themselves. This is one of the major things. They wrote books, they had newspapers. It became a mass movement. Who created it? Men and women with political self-respect and self-possession. You had the Southern farmer who was part of what was called the crop lien system. Okay? And this is a description of it. The furnishing merchant, who's a merchant in town, in a southern town. Remember, after the Civil War, there was very little money in the South. There was hardly any banking. Right? They had been destroyed, right? The furnishing merchant able to get most of their goods on consignment from competing northern mercantile houses, bought supplies, and furnished them on credit to the farmers, okay? Taking a lien on the farmer's crop, right? They're giving a loan to the farmer, loan of credit. He can come into the store and buy his goods on credit, but his crop can be taken from him if he doesn't pay at the end of the growing season, okay? That's the security. Farmers learned that the interest they were paying on everything they consumed limited their lives in a new and terrible way. The rates imposed were frequently well in excess of 100% annually, sometimes over 200%. At the heart of the process was a simple two-price system for all items. One item for the farmer in debt who went into the merchant and he got the credit price, which is a very high price for what his family needed to live so he could get his crop in. And another price if you had cash, it was cheaper to buy things in that store. And the farmers had no choice. They had no money. How were they going to feed their families? This is the crop lien system. And that's why they went in droves out to Texas to try to get away from it. This is another, I won't go into this, it's more description of it. This one I'll just say because I love it. at settling up time, the farmer and the merchant would meet at the local cotton gin. At that moment, the farmer would learn what his cotton had brought. The merchant then consulted his ledger for the final time. The accumulated debt for the year, he informed the farmer, exceeded the income received from the cotton crop. The furnishing merchant would then announce his intention to carry the farmer through the winter on a new account, the latter merely having to sign a note. It's all legal. They all had to sign, you know, these loan documents. Mortgaging to the merchant the next year's crop. Farmer, empty-handed, climbed in his wagon, drove home knowing that for the second or fifth or 15th year, he had not paid out. He was still in debt and still having to go to the merchant to get all the things he needed till the next crop. And this was endemic throughout the South. In the West, the Western farmer, he was in debt to the banks and the mortgage companies for his homes and his personal property because he needed credit in order to buy the land and then to develop the land. And again, let me repeat, from 1850 all the way to 1900, the money supply, because of who controlled it, was slowly getting less and less. The prices for the commodities that the farmers needed was going down and down. So they get into debt, but the price at which they're going to sell their product in order to have cash to get out of debt is getting less and less. They're not going to get out of debt, right? Just like today. How can the college students get out of debt if they can't get a job to get the money to pay the debt, right? It's all the same system. And this is just a description. A farmer with only a few dollars in his pocket comes out to the Midwest, takes a claim, goes into debt for the farm for sufficient money to prove it up, you know, clear those fields, and buy a horse or two. Then he goes in debt for the necessary machinery to harvest his crop. And by the time his grain is ready to sell, he is pretty well buried under a pile of debt. He takes his wheat to market, of course, firmly believing that it's nothing less than number one hard wheat, but the elevator man, which is the monopoly, you know, the railroad monopoly, but the elevator man's eagle eyes promptly discovers, well, it's been frosted, or it's damp. I can't give you that much for it. Here, you gotta take this. He had to take it. Right? What's he gonna do? He needs to sell his crop to get money. And he's forced from his necessities to sell for what he can get. The sun is now obscured by two or three blanket mortgages, and he sits down in his lonely cabin on the bleak prairies and imagines that he's being ground down by the despotic heel of monopoly, and he is. Railroads were a major monopoly. So this is, and let me just say, some historians might say, oh, well, this is why this movement came about, the condition of the population. But, you know, the condition of people throughout history has been pretty miserable like this at times, and there's not been a mass movement. I personally feel the reason that these farmers created a mass movement was, I don't know, something, you know, when you're connected to the earth, somewhere there's self-respect in you, and you're not going to sit there and just take it. I think that's why. I think there was some farmers who just, and you know, had self-respect, and they knew enough to say, we have to educate our farmers. Educate them about this system. And that's at the height of this mass movement, because it spread, and it spread really fast. At the height of it, every little town would have an alliance, you know, a little alliance. And one of the first things that the leaders who started this did is they made one of their leaders the traveling lecturer. Okay? It's like the educator. And he would go around and he'd meet with these little sub-alliances and he'd pick out the most articulate and energized of the farmers in that town, in that alliance, and he'd say, okay, you're the local lecturer. And he'd teach him, and then he'd teach all the other farmers in that sub-alliance. At the height of this mass movement, there were 40,000 lecturers in this movement. I read that and I said, wait a minute, this is a typo. I swear to God, I said, and then I had to go to another source, you know, to confirm it. 40,000 lecturers, farmers, they're just farmers like every of the other farms, but they knew there was, you know, something in this movement about education and getting clear on the system. How did it grow? Individual self-respect, collective self-confidence. Democrats, very democratic, they would have huge, they'd have these huge weekend meetings and tens of thousands of people would come just simply to talk and share what were the ideas that were being talked about the next step, right? Or what do we feel about that? A lot of real democracy. And they created, this is very important, they created their own culture, okay? The leadership knew that they couldn't accept the dominant culture. They had to create their own because, of course, the dominant culture was telling the farmer, well, it's your fault. You know, you're uneducated. You can't make your farm work. It's your fault, right? Don't we get that same message? If you don't succeed, it's your fault. You don't have enough education or, it's a system. And these farmers knew it, right? So they said, we're going to develop our own culture, which they did. They had hundreds of newspapers that were written by farmers. Hundreds. And they shared them. They knew that they had to have their own world away from the system itself that was oppressing them. And it grew. It had the organizational base of this institution called the Alliance. They recruited, one of the ways they recruited so many hundreds of thousands of farmers across the nation was the first thing they did was to say, okay, we're going to educate each other, but they came up with creative ideas. Let's form local co-ops so then we can put all of our crops together and sell them in bulk not to the local merchant, but sell them to the distributor, the warehouser, right? And they tried that. Sometimes they were successful, but what they found out was the big companies, the big distributors, the big banks that they had to deal with, they wouldn't work with them. They wouldn't give them on credit. They said, no, we'll only deal with you if you have cash. And these farmers don't have cash. Right? They're in debt. So sometimes they were successful, but not totally. Not as much as they would have hoped. They just couldn't get the sources of credit to work with them. Okay? The mass education, okay? And finally they turned, because the co-ops, they couldn't deal with what they needed through a cooperative movement of creating local co-ops of farmers, they ended up turning to become a third party called the People's Party, which in our history books we hear as the Populist Party. But they created it first and it was the People's Party. And what lessons did the Alliance learn, which we could learn from them, is immediate political action will not work. Too many of the poor are tied up in traditional modes of thinking. They believe that it's their fault, you know. Personal self-respect must be instilled in the membership. The movement had to support members educating each other in the lecture system. The cooperative idea spurred the organizational work that was very important to get people into the Alliance.
the democratic instinct would be released with education and a new political language shared in mutually supportive groups. They didn't release the language of the dominant culture. They created their own. What happened, and this is also to be learned, the People's Party was a third party. They created it, you know, after a lot of discussion. I mean, this is a big issue, whether they should become political or not. They created this third party, and what happened was, and I'm sure the same thing happens today, some of the leadership, and they were going towards the presidential election. 1892 was the first presidential election where they were proposing candidates. And this party, in 1896, was the next presidential election. And what happened was, there was a large group in the Farmers Alliance that said, no, we're not really going to get what we need at the national level unless we fuse with the Democratic Party. And then there was the other part of the leadership that said, no. That's the worst thing to do. We have to stay as a third party. And unfortunately, the fusion element won for various reasons. William Jennings Bryan, a Democrat, was supported by the People's Party as a fusion candidate. And his big thing was free silver, free silver, free silver. Meaning silver had coining of silver as money in the United States had stopped earlier in the century. And the idea, because the farmers knew there wasn't enough money, right? Their prices were going down. They couldn't pay their debts. So they knew that there wasn't enough money out there. So instead of sticking behind a third party and the greenbacks, they went with the Democrats, who usurped the issue by saying, well, we'll have more silver, we'll coin more silver, that'll increase the money supply, right? That would not have solved the issue, and it dissipated the energies of the movement by fusing with the Democrats. So it's something to be thought of in strategies today. What needs to be done for a more just money system? There have been monetary reformers, and before you leave, I just have to say, you have to know that the whole country of Canada, from 1938 to 1974, had publicly issued money. They debt-free, interest-free, direct from their government, circulated, and it gave the Canadian people their educational system, their healthcare system, that we all look at and say, wow, that's pretty neat, you know. Because of the money system. Mm. Now today in Canada, I have Canadian friends, they don't know about their own history, right? Because the people who control the money system don't want that in their heads. Remember, the Farmers Alliance knew about the history of public money. They lived with the greenback, right? That's one of the reasons that gave them their strength, because they were connected to that history. But I'll tell you, there are people, very brave people today, who are trying to get the message about this system and changing it. One of them is Dennis Kucinich. I don't know if anybody has ever met him, but I've never met him. But he,
well, he was rep from Ohio.
Didn't he run for president?
He did.
Oh, he did. But he was in the House of Representatives.
Yeah. Okay.
And what happened was, one of the monetary reform groups had a secretary, and she, you know, was secretary for years for them. And then she quit her job and went to Washington, where she met Dennis Kucinich. And she ended up marrying him. And through her, he learned about this. So he put a bill in Congress in 2011, H.R. 2990, Dennis Kucinich. And what happened was this. He put it into Congress
In 2011, he put it into Congress in 2012. He lost his congressional seat because they redistricted him. Because, I'm sure because of this. He's a brave man.
Was it ever voted on, or did it never get to the floor?
No, it never got out of committee.
Yeah, of course not.
But it was in committee. And he did it, he said. He did it to educate, unlike the Farmers Alliance, to educate the American people. He knew it wasn't going to get passed, but it was a way of educating, right? It has three parts. The Federal Reserve Banks will be owned by the government. So the government, just like in Canada, in 1938, the Canadian government went into the bank, privately owned Bank of Canada, and bought all the shares. Right? That's what would happen. That was the first part of his bill. Okay? So the Federal Reserve would truly be public. Okay? The privilege to create money will be taken away from private commercial banks. Okay? No more bank credit. No, we don't need it. It's not our money, it's private bank money with interest. Telling who's going to get money in our society. So, and it's simply, so you know, this, it's all accounting money. This 97% of bank credit is just on the ledgers, right? So, and I've worked in systems for 33 years, you know, I know, you just use a change in accounting rules, right? And you get rid of the bank credit. Because it's accounting, it's built into the rules of the computer system. You just change the rules and rewrite the program. It's not a big deal. You don't feel any different. You know, you still have the same amount of money in your checking account. But the banks at this point cannot create money. They have to take the depositors' money and loan it. They're not creating it anymore.
Is that how they used to be?
Since the Federal Reserve law, no.
I know, but
before 1913.
When the banks first started, is that what they did?
You have to look at each particular case. Okay. And the last part is the U.S. money is spent for the benefit of all citizens. The government is issuing the money. It's not money that gets created and then disappears out of when loans are paid off. It's just circulating. And, you know, of all the things we could share with people and try to educate people about, the money system is at the core of everything. So I think that any social group, any environmental group, any of those leadership and the membership in those groups, if they were taught this, would make it, this is like the key, this would probably cause more, it wouldn't, you know, if you change the system like Dennis said, suddenly you wouldn't have like a beautiful world, but you would have so much more control over your government. We don't have control over government because we have people who are able to make money and influence them. But this would be a key change to slowly turning this world around. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. You talked about Dennis Kucinich. Representative Ron Paul was also making a lot of noises about the Federal Reserve. Where does he fit in with the similar? I mean, is he sort of aligned with those similar? Was his? I'm not talking about the younger.
Right.
They are actually, you know, friends. You know, when Kucinich was in Congress, but they don't believe in the same solutions. Ron Paul is believing in something called the gold standard.
I mean, he wanted to get rid of the Federal Reserve.
No, we're not getting rid of it. We're
no,
just
that's what
making...
he wanted to do.
Oh.
Ron Paul.
Well, I don't know. I don't know all the details of what he thinks would happen.
He believes in the gold standard.
What?
In the gold standard.
Right. Yeah.
Which?
Any other questions?
So when the taxpayers bailed out the banks, what did we do? Go into debt to bail them out?
Oh, yeah.
So, but we bailed them out, but it was all on paper.
Yeah. Yeah, but our money is accounting money.
Wait, we borrowed money from them to bail them out?
Well,
we still need more other government.
We did a lot of different things.
Chinese government or
China.
China. Yeah. 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 Yeah